Good morning. This opens the February 13th meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We're going to change the order of proceeding slightly to accommodate some special guests that we have here. And we're going to begin with a presentation by the Oregon Wheat Growers League. And with that, I'd like to open an informational meeting and invite Mr. Tyler Hansel, Ms. Dana Tuckness, and pardon me, we're going to invite Mr. Blake Rowe up first.
Well, good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Blake Rowe. I'm the CEO for the Oregon Wheat Growers League, we've got several of our growers from around the state with us today. I'm going to take just a few minutes to sort of give you a very quick overview about wheat in Oregon, sort of set the stage, and then let the farmers tell you a little bit about their operations. So wheat's one of Oregon's largest and most valuable crops. Depending upon weather and acres in any particular year, we produce 50 to 70 million bushels of wheat. It's mostly soft white wheat. We're very widely distributed, produced in most of the counties in Oregon, and we account for about 30% of Oregon's harvested acres each year. Our crop is probably more focused than most on international markets. Roughly 85 to 90% of our wheat goes offshore, and we're typically Oregon's either first or second ranked export crop. So we commissioned OSU to do a little economic work for us in 2014 to get an idea of our economic footprint in Oregon's economy. So these figures are from that study, slightly lower now because wheat prices are down, but still wheat accounts for a large portion of Oregon's agricultural output. We support over 5,600 jobs when you count our supply chain and indirect employment. I guess one thing that we like to think of is we bring value into Oregon, sort of like foreign exchange. So because our sales are predominantly in the international market, that value comes back to Oregon and circulates in our economy. So this will give you a little bit more detailed picture of our markets over the last 5 years. You can quickly see the importance of the Pacific Rim for our wheat sales, including Latin America. A little more specific in terms of markets, here are the top 10 markets for soft white over the last 5 years. We played a leading role, if you go back in history, leading role in opening many of these countries, the markets in these countries. Last year, in specific, our largest customer, Japan, we celebrated the 60th anniversary of the wheat sales office that was opened by Oregon Wheat Growers in 1956 in Tokyo. In terms of the future, the real growth markets that we focus on, we're talking about Indonesia, China, Vietnam, the Philippines, those countries in Southeast Asia with growing middle class and growing populations. So probably the major issue that we face right now, frankly, is low wheat prices. So this gives you a track over the last few years of wheat prices in Oregon. These are in dollars per bushel. Remember, the farm gate price is less than this. You just have to back it out transportation to get it to Portland. For reference, these prices are roughly the same as they were in 1982 right now. But that's only part of the picture. So this is how our wheat looks to our customers. So I just picked one market. This is one of our better markets, Korea, long market, long-term market. So these figures are dollars per bushel, and the three things that are highlighted in yellow, those are various specs of soft white wheat, and this is the price that our customer sees delivered in Korea. And you can see that our price is higher than wheat from lots of other sources in the world. Those are folks we compete with. So just to give you an idea that while prices are low to us, our wheat's not necessarily the lowest priced wheat that our customers can access. It's a very competitive market. This is where we have to compete to survive. So I'm going to turn it over and let the growers share a little bit about their operations, and then I'll come back and give you a quick close, and we'll take some questions.
Wonderful. I want to ask a question, then I see some of my colleagues have questions. Mine is logistical. I have that Dana Teknes is coming to the, that's you, and Eric Oram. Is Eric here? Okay, so at the appropriate point, feel free to switch out. But for now, Rep. Post would like to ask a question, and then I see Rep. Gomberg is getting hand up.
Thank you. Blake, right?
Yes, sir.
Sorry, I want to make sure I get the right. So Blake, thanks for coming today. Appreciate it. Two questions just in back to what you were showing, just for economically challenged like myself. What's the, and that's probably just really a complicated question what I'm about to ask, but maybe the real simplified terms, what's the main cost drive? What makes the price what the price is of wheat?
So you're talking about the price to Korea?
Okay, let's pick Korea. Yeah.
So Chair Leininger and Representative Post, so the elements that are incorporated in that comparison, it's the cost of the wheat in the supplying country, the transportation cost to get it there, so that would include loading, unloading, shipping, handling, and those are all converted. Typically, wheat is priced in dollars, even though if it comes from Russia, it doesn't start in dollars, but when it gets to the customer, it's all priced in dollars. So there's a foreign exchange element there as well. Those are the basic elements that are captured there. Again, what we've tried to do is put them on the same basis, so they're delivered, converted to dollars, so you've got them all in the same currency and to dollars per bushel. Not every country sells in bushels, obviously.
Okay. All right. Then the second would just be, we have been hearing the last week or so about, this may be completely unrelated, but it made me think about it when I saw some of those numbers. The onions in eastern Oregon, are we about to hear, have you had the same issue with the snow and the ice and everything, or is the wheat moved fast enough that it's not an issue? Where are you at with this winter?
Chair Leininger, Representative Post, little different supply chains, because wheat generally moves in bulk. And we sell throughout the year, other than the fact that the Columbia River locks are in a maintenance cycle right now. We'd be moving wheat downriver to bulk export ships all through the year. That's one of our advantages, is we can deliver really on a continuous basis. Onions move in a little different supply chain. Dana Teknes can talk a little bit about that, but it's more of container. You don't see a bulk ship full of onions. So some of it goes to the same markets, but the shipping channels are a little bit different, and then you get into the fact that we don't have container service right now at the Port of Portland. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Rep. Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, gentlemen. If you could go back one slide, I've got a two-part question. You were talking about the amount of the number of dollars you get for product.
We'll see if I can go back.
Well, we don't need the slide. So let me ask my question. I'm interested in whether we have an advantage in terms of delivery cost compared to some of our competitors, and what the people buying our product are paying for it compared to other markets. And related to that, I wanted to ask what impact the changes in Terminal 6 have had on your industry.
Okay, several questions there. So Chair Leininger, Representative Gomberg. So those figures for delivered to Korea include the shipping costs.
Okay.
Right now shipping costs are relatively low. That's one of the reasons that Black Sea wheat, for instance, can compare all the way into the Pacific Rim, because freight costs are relatively low. Terminal 6 doesn't really affect wheat, because wheat is a bulk commodity, goes on bulk ships. It's not a container product. So that's just the nature of our supply chain. So we aren't wheat's not affected. That doesn't mean that our growers aren't affected, because many of our growers, they're multi-crop. They're, you know, onions, hay, all different kinds. And many of those commodities are severely affected by the loss of the container terminal. So our growers are affected, even though it's not the wheat part of their business that's impacted. And help me out. I'm trying to remember all the elements that you asked.
Well, those were the two key questions. I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Rep. Brock Smith.
I can wait if you like, Madam Chair. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Brown. How are you?
Morning.
I appreciate the information on the slides and how competitive your market is there, is that we finally got that slide up. And then in previous slides, you talked about how your company grows, or your industries have about 5,600 jobs here in the state of Oregon. And I'm curious, since it is so competitive, what has the, I've been reading a recent article about the orchard growers and how the minimum wage has increased as, you know, so had some issues there. How is it that affecting your industry and your business here?
Chair Leininger, Representative, I'm not sure if I say Representative Smith or Representative Brocksmith.
Brocksmith.
So minimum wage affects the supply chain. In terms of wheat, the minimum wage probably has a little less impact than it does on other crops, just because we don't have as much, let's say, compared to fruit growers. We don't employ quite as much of that kind of labor. So it does affect, I guess what I would say is it doesn't really matter what cost center you're talking about, minimum wage, taxes, freight costs, fuel costs. Because of the competitive global market, we're very limited in our ability to pass cost increases on to our customers, because they have all those options to buy from different suppliers. So when things happen in our market that raise our costs, even well-intentioned reasons to raise our costs, the farmers are in a bit of a bind. They can't necessarily raise their price to accommodate. So right now, most of our farmers probably are facing production costs that exceed the sales price of the wheat, and they can't pass on higher costs. So I guess that's you're stealing from what I was going to close with, but essentially that would be our request is remember that chart, because each time our operating costs go up, we can't pass that on. So we're just trying to be competitive and earn sustainable returns to our farms, and that is not easy.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for coming. Quick question on this. What are the acronyms in front of everything? I'm guessing SW stands for soft white. Is that right? And so there are varieties. And if that's true, then my question is, to the end user, to the buyer, does it matter whether they get soft white or they get another variety? Because I think that's, if I'm not mistaken, that's the reason for a big price differentiation there in the Portland, just in the Portland graph.
Correct. Chair Leininger, Representative Reschke. Sorry, there is a little bit of code there. Each of those represent an acronym. So let's take the Portland one. Hard red, HRS is hard red spring wheat. So that would be a high quality bred wheat. We grow a little in the Northwest, but most of it comes from the Midwest, sold through the Port of Portland.
Okay.
You're correct. Soft white, that's the SW. Let's take Australia. That's, I have to remember all these acronyms. APW is Australian Prime White. ASW is Australian Standard White. And there is a lot of differentiation in how wheats are used. So Okay. They're not totally interchangeable. The one that would probably be most interchangeable with soft white in that chart is the soft red winter.
Okay.
Coming out of New Orleans and the Gulf. But nevertheless, depending upon the customer and the application, you can substitute different kinds of wheat. So it's not perfectly interchangeable, but customers can do a lot when the price is enough different. They can do a lot.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Sure. All right. I have a question, and then we're going to thank you for being here and ask your colleague, Mr. Oram, to switch places with you and hear from these other gentlemen. My question is related to the demise of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How does that affect your industry, and how do you see the changing dynamics in our federal position vis-a-vis trade partners, and what it will mean for your sector?
That is a great question, Chair Leininger. We were just in Washington, D.C. at a national meeting a week or so ago, and that was a common theme. I think folks understand the Trump administration's perspective on TPP, but they don't exactly understand what comes next. So Trans-Pacific Partnership did make some important market moves for wheat in some of the, chiefly like Vietnam. But probably the potential of TPP was more in the countries that appeared ready to join the effort, like Indonesia. They weren't original TPP members, but they were poised to join in. I think it's an open question now of what happens if TPP completely gone, or is it just the United States that's not going to participate? I'm not sure we know. Does it affect us? Certainly. Some of those big growth markets I mentioned, those were countries that were poised to follow on and try to join in TPP, and obviously that won't happen now. So I'm not sure that we know yet exactly how the Trump administration will tackle those trade issues. Obviously, those markets are hugely important to us, but I just don't have a good answer for you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. And Mr. Orem, if you could come up. And Mr. Hansel and Mr. Tuckness, if you want to decide among the three of you who would like to go first, we will look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Chair Linder. My name is Tyler Hansel. I'm from Hermiston, Oregon, fourth generation farmer. Here in Hermiston, Oregon, we are all irrigated agriculture. We live in about a 9.5-inch rainfall, 7.5 to 9.5-inch rainfall. Real good at raising sand, that's about it. But with irrigation, we raise a very diverse group of crops. We have corn, wheat, barley, alfalfa, onions. We lease out for watermelons, potatoes, and carrots and onions. We also used to have cows, but we no longer have cows anymore. But the thing I wanted to talk most about was that we need to invest in our infrastructure for water and for our water storage, and for the state to be more proactive rather than reactive. We just went through a rather rough drought. I think we're coming out of it. California looks like they're really coming out of it. But Oregon needs to look ahead to think about what we're going to do in the future to try to develop storage for water. On our farm, we have three sources of water. We have wells that are in a critical groundwater. We have the County Line Water Improvement District, which happened to be, if you guys remember, 1069 came out in 08, I believe it was. That happened to be in our back door, or our backyard is right next to our already existing water infiltration into our alluvial aquifer. And then our next two sources are the Umatilla floodwater, where we take the floodwater that's typically at a very high stage where the fish aren't in need of it at that time, and we run it onto our crops. And then we have Mackay Reservoir, which is our third source, which is water that's stored behind an earthen dam and then released later in the season for us. You mentioned jobs and how that was effective with minimum wage earlier. For us, growing up, we used to hire anywhere from 3 to 9 summer employees. We had full-time on our ranch in Hermiston. We had 5 on our ranch up in Athena. We had anywhere from 3 to 4 full-time employees. Right now, we have 3 in Hermiston and 2 up in Athena. So we went from anywhere from 7 to 9 full-time employees down to 5. And our summer help, we typically now hire 1, as opposed to where we used to hire anywhere from 3 to 7. And then when you talk about terminal being closed, that's how we got a lot of our chemicals in. So even though it didn't directly affect wheat exports, it affects our imports of the commodities that we use to create it. You also wanted to talk about economic growth in our area. Some of the things that you guys have to deal with is, of course, in our area we have a dairy that's trying to get in. They're next to Boardman. It's about 10 miles away from my house, so it's pretty much is in my backyard. It's called the Lost Valley Ranch. It's looking at employing up to 150 people, I believe, not counting the resources that go around the dairy that help supply and support that farm that will be there. It's on a 7,000-acre ranch, and it's one of those things that when you have rules and regulations and people follow them and do it, it's really hard to then ask to change the rules and regulations as it's getting developed. I don't know if it's based off of them not having all their paperwork in earlier or what, but I'd like, you know, to see some motion on that. Another part about Eastern Oregon that I know wasn't directly involved with this committee, but I would like to call out jobs like a call center that was removed from Eastern Oregon and relocated down here in Salem. That hurts our communities tremendously. I understand that it was moved because of higher paying wage down here, but if we set up our borders for wages and then we move from one area to the next, just that hurts our small towns. I hate to see that be done. I know that wasn't your guys' decisions, but when you guys make decisions, please keep in mind that Eastern Oregon is not Salem. And, you know, what $13, or that's what they were being paid in Eastern Oregon, will do to a family compared to down here is a big difference. So with that, thank you, Chair, and I'll pass on to our next colleague.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for meeting with us. My name is Dana Tuckness. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer. My family moved to Malheur County in 1869, and we've been there ever since. My wife, Kathy, and I have a small farming operation. We've varied over the years. The past 1980 is when I started my own operation. So we varied in size from 300 to 1,300 all irrigated crops, onions, sugar beets, potatoes, wheat, corn, a variety of crops. I wanted to touch on the container issue as well, imports coming in, it has affected us very much on getting supplies in and chemicals and things like that. And of course, our exports, onions, potatoes, hay, and our seed crops from our area have been devastated because of the loss there. We've had to go a lot further distances to get our crops where they need to go. So, and as far as the minimum wage, we're right on the Idaho border there. And of course, we're looking at $10 this year. We're just across the river, 7.25. So with the loss of these onion sheds, apparently everyone knows of the snow problems we've had and the loss of the packing sheds and onion storage sheds. There's been talk even before this of many of those sheds moving across the river. It's just a short way over there to build a new shed. And now that they're going to have to build new sheds, we're thinking that's probably going to happen more often than what we had anticipated before. It looks, many of them are threatening to move over there. So many of those sheds hire thousands of employees, hundreds of employees for each shed during the packing season on onions, which is typically between August and April, all through the winter. So, and you look at a $3 difference in the wage times 100 every day or more, and you can see why it would be cost effective for them to move there. And our communities like Ontario, the city of Ontario, is very concerned about this, the businesses there, because they rely on ag, completely on ag. So my own operation, I used to raise a lot of onions. We decided to downsize a few years ago, and that was mainly due to the increase in minimum wage was our main reason we decided we'd better look at something different, because margins were getting thinner and thinner, and we can't set our price on any of these crops. We've got to take what we're given. So at one time I had five full-time employees. I'm down to one now. The four that I laid off, three of those moved out of state because they couldn't find work. One of them did find work locally and is still there close. But and I also hired as many as 150 part-time for field crews. So, and I don't do that anymore because I'm out of the onion business because of that. So I'm raising less labor-intensive crops, so I'm not hiring the people I was. And it's starting to affect the area pretty heavily, I believe. So.
So I'm going to invite our final speaker to speak, and then we can have questions at the end. Thank you, Mr. Tuckness.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Eric Oram, and along with my wife, Brandy, and our four children, we farmed a dryland wheat and cattle farm outside of Lexington in Morrow County. I am technically a first-generation farmer. We started farming in 2001, and by 2006, we started converting all our farm ground to direct seed, no-till. Today, all of our ground is in direct seed. We are building and restoring topsoil where it has been depleted with tillage. With all the benefits of direct seed and moisture, with all the benefits of direct seed, such as moisture conservation, lowering of emissions and reduced fuel usage, and almost complete elimination of wind and water erosion, it does have its challenges, one of them being herbicide dependence to control the moisture-robbing weeds and grasses in our crop and in our fallow ground. We are starting to see some herbicide resistance in our weeds, and some of our growers are even going back to full tillage to control the weeds. Also, with new and more regulation in pesticide application, we are seeing some growers abandon direct seed and going back to full tillage. Current cost of production is equal to or less than the market price. Input costs are on the rise. And even though I do not pay directly some of the new employment regulations, the added costs are passed to us through our vendors. In low markets, we are all looking for ways to cut costs. Having a public breeding program through OSU helps not only keep costs down compared to private seed companies, but also offers varieties of wheat that can grow better in the different climates of Oregon. Local extension is also very important in testing these wheat varieties against the privates, and also extension is very important in trying, testing, and teaching new and different conservation and herbicide practices. As growers and stewards of the land, we are doing everything we can to conserve our ground to leave it in better shape for our next generation. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Colleagues, any questions for this panel? We have Representative Brocksmith.
I just want to thank you for taking the time to come over here. I know it's not a short ride from Malheur County and from Morrow County, and I just want to put on the record that we really appreciate what you do for our state and our economies. Our farmers and ranchers are the backbone, and I thank you for taking the time to tell us your story.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
And we have Representative Marsh. Thank you.
And I know we all echo Representative Brocksmith. Thank you, Brocksmith's comments. I have a question. A few years ago, we had a big issue with GMO-infused wheat that got into the crop. And obviously, that's a huge issue when you're exporting because there are big concerns about that in the international market. I'm wondering if that's sort of where you think that issue is for you at this point, the potential for GMO contamination.
Chair Linger and Representative Marsh. So where we are, the United States have actually had three incidents in the last 5 years. State of Oregon was the first one. Mm-hmm. State of Washington was the last one. They ended up with 22 plants found in a fallow field with nothing else around them. Don't know how it happened. Mm-hmm. Where we are right now is with testing and appropriate import and export levels for plants that don't quite meet specs. We've been able to stay in that fairly well. We've had a very open dialogue with our importers. All the countries obviously are very wary, but we personally, as an industry, as Oregon wheat growers, we are not promoting that we have GMO wheat in our marketplace right now, because we don't have an export market that will accept it. So why push an issue when you don't have a market to sell to? We are also part of a national organization. We have other states that do not agree with us, but they don't sell internationally. They sell more locally. So right now, our stance is that that we need to have better control, obviously, and we have to have markets before anything is introduced. Does that help you?
Yes. It does seem that in a tight market, the quality of the product is an essential issue and an asset when you can guarantee that.
That price up there is solely based off of our quality.
Yeah.
That is, we have the best wheat. Possible, and soft white wheat is used to make some very high quality cakes and cookies in Asian markets as well as noodles. So that's why we are able to sell almost $2 higher than a lot of the other ones.
Right. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your work and for coming to the Capitol today to help us and our colleagues understand more about your industry and what you need and how we can be good allies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to transition to another presentation. This presentation, and for that, we'll invite Chris Alanak of the Legislative Revenue Office to the front. One of the duties of our committee colleagues is going to be doing the policy analysis on tax credit, potential tax credit investment bills. And Mr. Alanak is here to talk to us about the considerations that we should bear in mind, the direction that we've been given, I think, from the speaker, and sort of the tradition of how these things are evaluated as we move forward into a series of tax credit requests and proposals. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And just as a backup to that, very high level, in 2009, the legislature put sunsets on all of the tax credits. And then since then, the process for reviewing them has been modified over time. And last session, the Legislative Revenue Office was required to produce a report on all of the sunsetting tax credits. The report that was released this year is the second version of that. And there are about 15 tax credits are going out to policy committees. So what I've been asked to come and talk about is just the process that leadership had in mind for how this is to work. And basically, every policy committee has the option to go through the tax credits that are before them. So like for this morning, you have an electronic commerce zone tax credit. And it's kind of a reset for that tax credit. It's checking in on the policy to make sure it's doing what it's supposed to be doing or what the legislature hopes it's doing, and if it should be modified in any way. So a couple of the resources in the report are a review of the policy purpose. Every section, the report is rather long, and there's a lot of information about the process. But for each tax credit, there are basically kind of four sections of information. There's a review of the policy purpose, where I went back to the original legislation to try and determine what the purpose of the tax credit was. Generally speaking, the policy purpose is not in statute, so there's some room for interpretation, but I try to provide some context and some discussion of what the legislature has discussed in the past. There's a description of the provision. So for the electronic commerce one, it's a 25% investment tax credit. It's very targeted. I think you're going to hear a lot more about that this morning. And then there is an other section basically talking about other credits that are the tax credits that other states may offer, and maybe some discussion of administrative issues. And then there's a policy analysis that goes through to try and goes back to academic literature or any other kind of research that touches on the policy. The particular credit you have before you this morning is one of three enterprise zone tax credits that are in the report. And the policy analysis for all of those is around all of the enterprise zone credits as opposed to just electronic commerce zone tax credits. And one of the issues with that particular credit, in other states, they have broad investment tax credits that aren't necessarily geographically targeted like the enterzone policy is. So the hope of leadership is that the committee will analyze and review the tax credit within the report, there are some policy questions that are meant to serve as starting points for your discussion or help in your discussion and review. And basically, check in on the tax credit and evaluate the policy purpose. And if possible, refine or change or clearly state what the committee believes the purpose of the tax credit is. And that's really a foundational piece for subsequent reviews of the tax, any tax credit. In order to evaluate a tax credit, we need to know what the intent is. So that's kind of the big picture. And then within that, one of the things I've been adding is the potential discussion of any metrics that might be valuable in evaluating that. As clear as the committee can be on the policy purpose, and then any kind of discussion of metrics helps state agencies, other stakeholders understand what the legislature is looking for with this policy and how it's going to be measured. The metrics don't have to be sophisticated. Oftentimes, just simple pieces of information can go a long way. And it's really, rather than going down the path of a black and white perspective of does this credit do X or not, it's more of a discussion and an ongoing review of the function of the tax credit and what it's hoped to achieve. And so that's really what they're hoping for, is any information, any modifications you'd like to make the tax credit, because it's really up to the committee. It can be passed along as is, it can be not passed along, and it can be passed along in any modified form. And if that goes to JTAX, then for JTAX, it'll be kind of a ways and means process, where they'll have all the tax credits that they get from the various policy committees and the revenue chairs and leadership and the co-chairs will probably be discussing some sort of tax credit budget. At least that's what's happened in the past. So the budgetary issues or the spending issues are to be handled, I guess, ideally within JTAX. Now, that's easier said than done, because as you're crafting the policy, there's always the question of how much it's going to cost. So that enters the discussion in one way or another.
I'm going to jump in. So that's the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, right?
Yes.
So that's the House and Senate members of the Revenue Committee who serve also as the Tax Credit Evaluation Committee. And if they have essentially a budget of the amount that they can forego through tax credits during a year and still get to a balanced budget, then they decide kind of on a hierarchy of need which tax credits get to be above the threshold for the budget.
Right. Yeah. Sorry about that. But that's really the purpose, or as I understand it, for the policy committees. It's really taking a step back and evaluating the policy and the functioning of the tax credit as it currently exists, and then making any modifications and sending that on to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Alanek?
I just want to say, Madam Chair, I'm feeling like I'm reflecting back on what, about 8 to 10 years ago when I was in revenue with Chris being here. I'm starting to get the hives right now.
Revenue has that effect on people. I see four current and former revenue folks up there.
Yeah. Rep Resch.
Thanks, Chair Leniger, and thank you for coming. When you do your calculations on tax credits, is it just a loss of revenue that's seen, or is it also viewed with being an economic driver that can potentially generate more revenue than is lost?
Chair Leniger, Reschke, there are a couple pieces there. For the formal revenue impact statement that accompanies all the legislation, it's just that direct impact piece.
So a loss to revenue then?
That part is. And then there's other policy analysis that can get at some of the deeper issues. So okay. It's kind of there are two avenues there.
Okay, thank you.
I would say our role is essentially to do that return on investment, because there's a quantified revenue foregone, but we're supposed to probe what the benefit is in exchange for that. Is that right? Could you define for us, I know that in prior revenue committee meetings, folks have had these numbers handy. Do you know off the top of your head what the total amount of expenditure is per biennium through tax credits in the state of Oregon's budget? I recall it's quite a substantial number, which I think is what gave rise to decisions made before I was elected. I think Rep. Olson may have been part of this, to do a check-in every 6 years via sunset provision to make sure that the things that we're doing instead of collecting money are essentially worth doing, because it's a big figure, that a revenue foregone.
Yes, Madam Chair. For 17-19, the total credits, this is all credits, is about $1.6 billion. But about a key footnote to that is the personal exemption credit. That's about $1.2 billion. And the personal exemption credit isn't a policy credit per se. It's a revenue policy, but it's not an economic development policy, for example. That's a tax credit that just about everybody can claim. It's a couple hundred dollars, and for a family of five, they get five of them. It's a way of implementing kind of a 0% tax bracket. So it's a revenue policy issue. So there's just that footnote. So that leaves about $400 million in tax credits that are, I would say, policy oriented.
That's helpful. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? All right. Thanks so much, Mr. Allen. Sure. I appreciate it. And with that, we're going to close the informational hearing that we've had earlier today and open a public hearing on both House Bill 2070 and House Bill 2243, because they're quite closely related, and we have witnesses to testify only on one of the two. And with that, I'm going to invite Mr. Crawford to describe the two measures for us, please.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, House Bill 2073 extends the sunset for tax credits for the electronic commerce and enterprise zone, or city designated for electronic commerce zone, from January 1st, 2018 until January 1st, 2024. House Bill 2243 does the exact same thing, but also increases the maximum number of allowable electronic enterprise zones from 15 to 20, allows two zones to be designated on January 1st, 2018, January 1st, 2019, and January 1st, 2020. Sets the maximum credit allowed in 1 year at $2 million, allows a taxpayer with allowable credit in excess of their maximum liability to elect to receive an 80% refund on that credit in lieu of any carry forward, and takes effect 91 days after sine die.
All right. So with that, I'm going to invite up Nick Batts and Arthur Fish of Business Oregon to speak to those bills. And then on deck, we have Dan Eisenbeiss and Andy Reid with the City of Portland, and then Wendy Johnson, League of Oregon Cities. Welcome, gentlemen. Please state your name for the record and let us know what's on your mind.
Thank you. Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Batts. I am the Government Affairs Manager for Business Oregon. We are here today in support of House Bill 2243, Business Oregon's bill on electronic commerce tax credit. We feel it is an important tool for our work with local partners. As the administrator mentioned, the bill does three primary things. It extends the sunset from 2018 to 2024. It increases the number of zones from 15 to 21 spread out over 3 years. And it includes new provisions for better reporting and clawback. And with that, I will hand things off to my colleague, Mr. Fish.
Thank you, Nick. Chair Leininger, members of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade, appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Art Fish with Business Oregon, and I just wanted to give you a little technical review about enterprise zones and this particular tax credit. As many of you may know, there are 69 enterprise zones around the state, and they can be whatever number more than that potentially over time by local sponsorship, and they serve variety of businesses, including food processing and ag, as you heard earlier. A business, mostly, you know, the businesses that are using the enterprise zones for the most part are receiving a property tax exemption. They get their new property exempt for 3 to 5 years, subject to employment increases, which are like 10% of their existing workforce in general. Now, in 15 of those 69 zones, there is a little special treatment for electronic commerce businesses, those that are engaged in activities over the internet that actually involve transactional activities as opposed to, you know, the more what you might think of as more manufacturing oriented types of activities that the enterprise zones generally induce. And these companies still have to qualify for the property tax abatement, including the jobs increase and so forth within the enterprise zone. And as a function of that, they can claim this tax credit on their state taxes. and the credit is equal to 25% of the investment they make in new capital assets related to e-commerce and order fulfillment and those sorts of activities. And we have found it to be a very powerful sort of combination of tools that have helped to drive this sector and in these 15 zones, that can come, which have changed a little over time. It's been around for quite a while, and we've seen the e-commerce industry, of course, become, you know, very much sort of integrated into a lot of different types of activities, naturally. And with that, I would just summarize again some of what Nick mentioned, that, you know, this would add a few more zones. We do have, as some of the things we've put up in OLIS indicate, quite a number of interested communities out there that are regular enterprise zones, but not one of these particular e-commerce overlays. It would provide to make the credit a little more powerful. I mean, a lot of them are claimed but not used, and because a lot of businesses don't have necessarily the tax liability, so there'd be some kind of a neat idea of partial refundability. We are very interested in learning more about who actually is using the credit and that sort of thing. So there's some provision for them to report on that in claiming their property tax exemptions. And then finally, we're just shoring up the clawbacks and so forth, as well as extending the sunset, the typical 6 years. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or cover anything I may have overlooked. But again, my appreciation.
Do we have any questions? Rep Marsh.
Yes, thank you so much for your presentation. I appreciate the fact that this is going to go on to a tax credit review committee, but I still think we need to talk a little bit about the fiscal impact of some of the recommendations that you put forward, primarily the refundability up to 80%. You note in your presentation that it would have minimal impact on 17-19 because it wouldn't really be in effect, but I think it's incumbent on us to understand what the long-term impact could be on the budget. Have you done any analysis to show what a refund system like that might cost us out of hand?
Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh, members of the committee, no, we have not. We did postpone it, its effectiveness, I mean, part as well as for fiscal impacts, as well as for revenue impacts. I think when you say fiscal, you actually mean, in terminology here, the revenue impact. And I am looking forward to seeing, in working with Legislative Revenue Office in, you know, a revenue committee or JTAX, respective to figuring out what that would amount to in future biennia. It could be restricted in other ways too, with other additional sidebars. But right now, it's meant as a talking point for consideration of ways to make this, potentially a much more potent tool.
I think as we do the cost benefit analysis down the road, that having those numbers is obviously critical.
Chair Leininger, Representative Marsh, members. I mean, you could entreat legislative revenue to perhaps do some preliminary work before it leaves your committee. Is my thought. I mean, we don't really have the ability to get into necessarily figuring that out in any way that I would think should be represented as official. And
that's a good point. Thank you. Would you? I think it would be useful to have some information from legislative revenue on what the longer term impact of this is expected to be. So, if we could have some follow up on that, that'd be great. Rep. Reschke, you look as if you have a question.
I do. Thank you. we're tracking. That's good. Chair Leininger, I got notice that the Klamath Economic Development Association sent you a letter this morning at 8:08 concerning this bill, and I want to make sure that gets into the record. So,
thank you.
They notified me that they sent that to you. And then a question here. It's a question of clarification of how the process works for determining what an economic zone, where it is and what it is. Is it driven from the community outward, or is it driven from Business Oregon through this committee downward?
Chair Leininger, Representative Reschke, members of the committee, it is driven from the local level. This committee, or I should say the legislature as a whole, creates a sort of overall cap among the existing enterprise zones that may have this e-commerce thing. And again, these are all layers of sort of rationing and basically kind of controlling some of the fiscal impacts or revenue impacts, if you will. And our job is really just to kind of, at this point under current law, is just to open up the gates when there's one available. Like when one of these existing zones sunsets, and you know, try to say who comes in first. Right now, we don't apply any criteria to the decision.
Okay. So it's first come, first serve basis.
Correct.
Type deal. And I guess a follow up question would be what's the downside and what's the upside of just making Oregon an entire economic development zone, as opposed to excluding certain areas and including others?
Well, Chair Leininger, Representative Reschke, members of the committee, part of the reason we have the zones is to focus on certain areas of economic hardship. I mean, to be an e-commerce enterprise zone, an enterprise zone needs to be first designated, which, again, is a locally driven decision. There's no cap on the overall number of enterprise zones that can exist. But I think the reason we use the enterprise zones is, one, we don't want this to be where people may not locally want it. So there's the local choice. There is the focus on economic hardship. So some places that may want one can't have one for economic reasons. And then, you know, obviously to put some sort of parameters on the cost, why there's only 15 of so many enterprise zones that have the e-commerce thing is, again, I think gets back to Representative Marsh's point that, you know, if all 69 had this, then the investment tax credit, for better or worse, would be used that much more heavily, and there would be that much more of a revenue impact. But, I mean, these are the sorts of things that I think deserve consideration. I believe the addition of even six more zones as proposed in the bill deserves to be considered in that light.
Thank you.
Any other questions for?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a comment here. Art was really helpful to me here probably about 7 years ago when we were working toward expanding the enterprise zone down in Albany. Local governments got involved, and the county Association of Oregon Counties, as well as League of Oregon Cities, did as well. But I mean, we were able to move that bill through a short session back in 2010, and I mean, he helped quite a bit with that. So
that's
appreciate
great.
That.
Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. And thanks for your presentation. I, too, in Curry County, before I left office, we did a countywide enterprise zone of over 14 square miles. It's definitely a tool that we have that needs to be used. I was on a different committee. When it comes to, you know, tax credits and incentives, you know, I can understand that sometimes it gets a little problematic. We have proposals of tax credits to for green industries and across the board here in the state that I'm finding as I move through as a freshman here in this legislature. But the majority of these jobs are green jobs. The majority of these tax credits, well, I'm looking at your list on who, you know, there are some that, but the benefits, I think, at the first glance outweigh the revenue losses. So I look forward to our new charge, actually, Madam Chair, to go through the tax credits with this committee and make the recommendations that are necessary.
Additional comments? Do we have in the meeting materials, gentlemen, an estimate of the number of new jobs or the additional economic output that passage of the bill might catalyze? Sort of the metrics of success? Because I last biennium, we passed a bill that mandated legislators to assess how we'll know if a tax credit is effective by identifying some metrics of success.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, I mean, part of what you're referencing from the last session may relate to legislative revenue, and they're comparing their past estimates with actuals, and actually they do a very, very fine job of that in their latest volume here of tax credit review, and I think that's very important, and I really wish to sort of applaud Chris Allenack's points about, you know, developing greater metrics. And to that end, we've there's a good whole paragraph, if you will, in the testimony we submitted to OLIS that goes through sort of the existing effect, you know, kind of combining both the property tax and the investment tax credit programs as a whole. And it is a very sort of complementary leverage type program, and looked at about 2,400 jobs associated with various programs. I mean, some of those companies may not be at all using the tax credit. We have no access to actual tax credit data, of course. Department of Revenue would have to commit a felony to let us know much. Legislative revenue has greater access, but as far as how much more jobs and so forth we would get from some of these proposals, you know, that's a very good question. Some of the zones that have e-commerce are you know, fairly large cities, so I can't imagine that their experience would necessarily be repeated in maybe some of the additional zones that we would add, but it might be very good in more rural situations. So there's a number of things to discuss, but hopefully as sort of a attempt at somewhat sophisticated but still fairly simplified metrics, we've taken a first step with what's in our testimony there.
Great. Thank you. All right. Well, this is helpful. It's a good intro conversation on important ideas for increasing economic opportunity. So thank you. And I'll now invite up Dan Eisenbeis, Andy Reid, and Wendy Johnson to provide comments. And then again, colleagues, this is our first bite at the apple of some tax credit bills, so we'll need to reflect on our charge and reflect on the good information that we have on the record and in testimony today as we prepare to move forward. Welcome. Please begin in any order.
Good morning. Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. With me here this morning is Andy Reid from the Portland Development Commission. We'd like to offer our support for House Bill 2243, and in particular, extending the sunset and making this tool available to more communities throughout Oregon. Andy will provide some information about Portland's experience using this tool. We'd also be happy to address any questions you might have.
Thanks.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Andy Reid. I am the Enterprise Zone Manager at the Portland Development Commission. I manage two enterprise zones with approximately 55 companies enrolled currently. As Daniel just mentioned, we're here to support the extension, the sunset of the e-commerce tax credit and the potential expansion of the program as a whole. We have found it to be extremely useful to us in the city of Portland, and would appreciate having our fellow jurisdictions have the ability to use the tool as well. E-commerce companies are job generators. We have combined a number of companies that are using the program right now or have begun to look at using it, such as Instrument Marketing, Jaguar Land Rover, RenTrack, Simple Finance, Treehouse, Viewpoint Construction Software, Cascade Energy, and Salt and Straw are ice cream makers up in Portland. Combined, these companies are creating an estimated 500 new jobs as part of the Enterprise Zone program. And these companies, generally speaking, have higher wages than we're going to see in the general Enterprise Zone companies coming through. Our current average wages in the city of Portland in these zone companies is $28.41 an hour, which is very high. And we're experiencing that the e-commerce companies typically are at the higher end of that range. We also have experienced that the e-commerce companies that we work with are really on the forefront of pushing for helping us in our initiatives to create equitable opportunities for our residents in Portland. Many of these companies are signing extra public benefit agreements to do everything from increasing their communities of color and their hiring practices, setting up incubators incubators for small businesses in entrepreneurs in our underrepresented populations as well. So they really are taking an extra step beyond just the basics of what's required in the Enterprise Zone program to help us to meet our objectives at the Portland Development Commission in the City of Portland. And so these are model companies. These are the ones that we want to see grow in Portland. Of those companies I mentioned, only one, Jaguar Land Rover, is not homegrown. So these are businesses that are from Portland or from the area, and we want to see and be able to support them as they grow into their next stages. And finally, I would say that software and therefore e-commerce, are really, this is one of our target clusters that we spend our time on at the Portland Development Commission. And this is really a strong tool that we can use to attract those businesses to the Portland area. They can really locate anywhere, and they can put their employees anywhere. And we're just seeing that with the telecommuting and those options in that industry, that having a tool to have them put the physical infrastructure in this state is a really good way to go about doing this. And really, this is the future. E-commerce is where all industries are going. Our manufacturers, whether it's food or metals, they're doing e-commerce now as well. And so we are experiencing a need to be able to support companies as they're making those e-commerce investments. So thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
That's great. Thank you. That's really helpful. Ms. Johnson.
Good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm trying to get my bearings in economic development, since usually I'm dealing with these bills in the Revenue Committee. We're still waiting for some of those detailed paperwork, but I want to make a few points. That first, enterprise zones are generally a local discussion. These local governments are giving up their property taxes. So they've made an intentional decision at the local level that making that investment is what the community needs and the area is correct. So you've had that decision first, and then this overlay for the e-commerce zone is a state investment. And so we're here to support the bills because they provide some skin in the game from the state and help provide an added incentive that's necessary, because we're talking about pretty costly investments in these types of companies, and we just need the partnership to continue to bring jobs to Oregon. So we do support both bills. The one bill is just a sunset extension. The other is both the sunset extension plus allowing more communities to add these e-commerce zones. So on that point, we support the bill because we only have 15 of them now, and we have a list of communities who want to add this overlay, but were simply denied because they didn't get it in first. And the Business Oregon has a list of those that had applied that didn't make it into the last cut, and then a list of other communities who are interested. There are 69 e-zones, as Business Oregon noted. 54 of those are rural, and 15 are urban. But when you look at the electronic commerce, it's still a new tool, and we'd like to see it in more communities. And so we need to expand the number for that to happen. Lastly, the number of jobs. Overlays do add jobs, and LRO's report gives you a lot of that detail. A question was asked earlier about it. I think it's on page 32, where it lists out the hundreds upon hundreds of jobs that are happening in these e-commerce zones. So for those reasons, the League supports continuing it. We know that tax credits are at a premium when you're dealing with budget shortfall, but this is one of those tools that is important across the state, and we'd like to see it continue. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. All really helpful testimony. Thank you. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This could be for anybody. What's the analysis of how we do in competing against other similarly situated states and or towns and cities against their e-commerce zones, or cities that don't have them that also seem to be doing well?
Chair Leininger, Representative Helm. When we talk with site selectors, and so that's typically the person, a broker or a site selector, who's going to come to us and say, you know, here's our client and here's what we're looking to do. And it really is one of a number of factors, location, location, location. Obviously, that's kind of how businesses make their first decision. But it does get brought into the conversation, and it's pretty common that these site selectors and brokers will ask them after the fact, how much has this helped in terms of making the decision to locate in Portland in particular? And to a person, they say, yes, this was instrumental in us making the decision that Portland was going to be a market we were going to go to. Some businesses, I believe Mr. Fish referenced, don't have the liability yet, the tax liability to use the e-commerce tax credit. And so we're talking about businesses that are pretty stable and that have already gone through a pretty strong enough growth stage that they can, they're going to be quality companies and not just kind of blowing in the wind. So
thank you.
Any additional thoughts? I have one question for you. If part of our charge is to help define what success looks like, if we give a strong endorsement to this bill as we send it on to the next committees, do you think it's realistic for us to seek an estimate or a range of either jobs that might be created if we strongly endorse either or both of these bills, and or if it's a more flexible metric, economic output that we are hopeful this will generate? I feel like we are hearing from Chris Allenack and from the leadership folks that they want us to do an assessment of why it's a good idea to say yes or to say no. And I'm strongly interested in supporting these, but I wonder if you think we could realistically come up with some sort of definitions of what success would look like going forward, so that 6 years from now, when people look backward, they have a chance to say, yes, darn it, that was great, or surpassed our expectations, or for some reason it didn't quite hit the mark, so we need to rethink.
Chair Leininger, I believe that, so at the Portland Development Commission, we sign a written agreement with every enterprise-owned company that we have participate with us. And we track a number of data points. And it would be really interesting to see if there was an ability to track stronger data at the state level, we could then compare against what we're experiencing on the ground when we do our annual compliance. And we do that two times a year. And through the state exemption claim forms, but also we also have an annual compliance we do in the fall, just to make sure that they're meeting the obligations under the local conditions as well as the state statute. And so I do think that there would be an opportunity, speaking for the city of Portland, can't speak for other jurisdictions and how they go about doing their tracking as well, but companies are pretty open to share with us about where they're at and where they're going, and we get good data from them.
Thank you. I see that Rep. Olson.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. So, Andy, I mean, there are measurements in place, right? I mean, so it's not like we're going to be moving in here not having any understanding that what's being presented to us is going to fall on its face. I mean, in order for it to be successful, you have measurements, and you're required by law to have to follow those.
Chair Leininger, Representative Olson, absolutely, there are measurements in place, and we very strictly follow those and make sure that we're complying with those and get those reports out to the various entities that need to have them when it's time to report.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay, thank you so much. All right, I don't see any other people signed up to testify or rushing the podium here, so I'm going to assume that we have no more people to testify for today. And with that, is there anything else that we need to discuss for the good of the order? Representative Brocksmith.
I don't know if Representative Rischke was...
No, I'm just worried about people rushing the podium.
Right. You didn't realize that was a risk, but, you know.
That's why I'm on the end.
All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on these two good bills, House Bill 2070 and House Bill 2243. And we'll circle back to these because they're important, and this was our first conversation. But for today, we'll adjourn the meeting.